This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with author Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz about her new book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. We trace the history of gun violence in the United States and discover its connection to conquest. We'll talk about how Catholic-affiliated hospitals' strict guidelines often do great disservice to women of color.
This is an important issue on the separation of church and state. Even though taxpayers pay for Catholic hospitals, it's the male bishops that decide what kind of care female patients are going to get.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Today on Law and Disorder, I am delighted to have my friend and colleague Johanna Fernandez joining me in the studio while Michael Smith is away for a couple of weeks. Johanna is a professor of history at Baruch College and has been a longtime leader and activist in many issues, but especially in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. That's actually how we met. Johanna, we haven't reported recently on the status of Mumia's case. We know he's had some health care issues, and Guild members Bob Boyle and Brett Grody have been handling that case with a lot of support from the campaign to bring Mumia home. But there's been somewhat of a breakthrough in another aspect of his case in light of a Supreme Court decision. Can you explain briefly what's happening?
Yes, Heidi. So Mumia's conviction could potentially be challenged. And this is an exciting development in this very important case of the most famous prisoner in the world. The reevaluation of the case is based on a relatively recent Supreme Court decision, Williams versus Pennsylvania, that establishes that a prosecutor turned judge cannot review the appeals presented by the defendant to the court. So this is the first time in the history of the Supreme Court that a case has established the parameters of judicial bias. That is, a prosecutor cannot judge the appeals in a case
when he or she had actually worked or been somehow involved or had a link to that case
previously.
Right. Kind of astonishing that it's taken this long to get from the Supreme Court hints about the parameters of this kind of impropriety. To us, it's common sense.
Absolutely. It's something that astonishes regular person on the street that this has taken so long to establish this thing we call judicial bias that's cited all the time. In this case, the perpetrator is Ronald Castile. Ronald Castile was prosecutor in Philadelphia, in fact, top prosecutor. He was the DA for many years in the 1980s and 90s, and later he became the Supreme Court judge in the state of Pennsylvania. So the top prosecutor and the lead perpetrator in this instance is Ronald Castile. Ronald Castile served as DA of Philadelphia, was involved in prosecuting Mumia, and later in the 1990s became the chief judge in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And essentially, part of what the courts are reevaluating at this moment is whether the DA had some kind of significant involvement in the prosecution of Mumia, which should have led the judge to recuse himself when reviewing Mumia's appeals. So a judge in the Court of Common Pleas of Philadelphia is requesting that the DA's office release all of the files. And in fact, the DA's office released the files, and now we're in the process of reviewing the files to identify precisely what involvement Ronald Castile had as prosecutor in Mumia's case.
Right, and that might come in the form of notes on a piece of paper related to Mumia.
Memos. Signatures.
Exactly. Johanna, thanks so much for that update. We look forward to staying in touch with you about developments in this case, and we send our best to our friend Mumia.
Thank you, Heidi.
In her engaging new book called Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz chronicles the history of U.S. gun culture and its casualties. From Andrew Jackson, the slave trade, the extermination of indigenous populations, domestic terrorist organizations such as the KKK, to serial killings, U.S. history is rife with violence. What is the underpinning for such violence? Dunbar Ortiz argues that it's the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the resulting gun culture that it has spawned. She lays out an array of historical facts and figures that will be new information for many readers. In doing so, she provokes questions about the American ethos to help inform pressing issues confronting the nation, from mass shootings in schools to police killings with impunity. In her meticulously researched book, Dunbar Ortiz investigates the dynamics of armed struggle within the U.S., their motivations, and their contemporary relevance. Publishers Weekly writes, in her trenchant analysis of the Second Amendment, Dunbar Ortiz avoids a legalistic approach and eschews the traditional view that links the First Amendment to citizens' need to protect themselves from a tyrannical government. Instead, she argues that the Second Amendment was passed to facilitate the genocide of Native Americans in order to steal their land and to provide a means for slaveholders to control their human property. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is a historian, author, memoirist, and speaker who researches Western Hemisphere history and international human rights. Her 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was the fundamental document at the first United Nations Conference on Indians in the Americas, held at the UN's headquarters in Geneva. Her other books include Outlaw Woman and the acclaimed An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Her newest book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, is published by City Lights. And joining me to speak with Roxanne is Professor Johanna Fernandez, who teaches history at Baruch College here in New York. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's good to be with you again.
Your wonderful new book is a history of the United States through the lens of gun culture. What did this reveal through your research, and if you will explain, how does this differ from our traditional historic perspective of the U.S.?
I think that these things are known. It's not like they're in secret documents or something, but there's this, you know, United States of amnesia, so mainly the victims of U.S. history know that history kind of instinctively. They may not know all the details and all, but they know, for instance, that there's a connection between slavery, slave patrols, and modern police. You know, it's just so obvious. And the same with the violence of taking the land, you know, the hoarding of guns from the very beginning to control Native people. And then by the late 17th century, when slavery had gotten, you know, completely institutionalized, this, you know, this introduction of slave patrols out of those militias. So the next connection with that is that, isn't that what the Second Amendment is about? Because what else would it be about? So I think it's just the historical perspective, you know, mine mainly comes from being completely immersed in the indigenous perspective of U.S. history, which is really telling. It's not the whole story, but the story can't really be told in any way without it. And the same, of course, with slavery and the development of capitalism in the United States. So just that, just the economic history. What is the main source of capital in developing capitalism? Is land, real estate, taken from the Indians, land speculation, real estate speculation to this day, and African bodies as capital, collateral as commodities, not only, you know, besides being free labor, unpaid labor. So there is a struggle. I know Gerald Horn is hard at work at it, and many, many historians, Native and African American, are hard at work in shifting this historical perspective. So I see the gun thing. It wasn't something I would have thought of writing about, you know, as an important example. Except it's so prominent in the news, and as a divide between liberals and right-wingers and urban and rural, or that's how it's explained, and with a mystification, why do people want all these guns? And people all over the world, what is it about, you guys? Why do you want these guns, and why is it so important? And why does the average gun owner own 8 guns instead of 1? I think it's just, you know, being asked to write this by Greg Ruggiero, who read my Indigenous People's History of the United States, and I have one paragraph in that book stating the basic thesis about the Second Amendment and the sacredness of it, you know. And that leads me also to the whole question of timely, you know, related to your show, A Nation of Laws. But the law is not rational, or it creates a rationality like the legalization of slavery, the legalization of colonialism with control of Native peoples to this day, the legalization of the annexation of half of Mexico. So these laws, so-called, are built into, you know, supposedly a constitution which, yes, is very open-ended and vague and can be pored over, but is considered, you know, by liberals, often liberal constitutional lawyers like Obama, as something sacred. And that's unusual, too, because no one else, no other country in the world considers their constitution sacred. Most countries in the world do not have constitutions, including Great Britain. France has had several. Practically every generation, they do a new constitution. And ours is set in stone and to be debated about its original meaning, its actual meaning. And I think that's very should be questioned, and that's the setting for the Second Amendment being sacred.
Roxanne, part of what you start with in your book is this reality of mass shootings in the United States. And we know that a disproportionate number of white males are the perpetrators in the United States of mass shootings. What I find really riveting about your book is that you take a contemporary problem and you trace its roots in American history. You essentially tell us that we tend to revere the Second Amendment in the United States, and we associate the Second Amendment with a right bequeathed to us by the Constitution. But this obsession with guns in the United States predates that. And part of what you argue really wonderfully is that the emerging state required of the people who settled these lands service. They were required to be citizen soldiers because this was a colonial settler state. from its inception that was battling Native Americans and controlling black bodies. Can you tell us some of the details of that history and the laws that emerged that required white men and women to carry guns in the emerging American state?
Yeah, that's really the crux of it, the nature of settler colonialism. It's complex because I think we've come to understand European colonialism in general and the horrors of all colonialisms. But the settler colonialism has been dealt with less because these places became successfully European-dominated and eradicated, either mostly all, like Argentina, although never in any, I guess Uruguay would be the one you would say is the most ethnically cleansed. But there are very few outside the Anglo Empire. There's New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and the United States. And then in the later Spanish Empire, they started imitating the Anglo, you know, the very successful Anglo ethnic cleansing and settler colonialism in settling the cone of South America, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay. So you see almost exactly the same kind of manifest destiny, the same kind of nationalism. But there's one difference, one important difference, in the treatment of the indigenous peoples. It's exactly the same and exactly as brutal, if not more, say, in Australia or Argentina than in the United States. All those comparisons are, you know, it's so bad, but it's even worse than bad in those places, that you really have a whole country that emerges and is dominant long enough to set everything up institutionally so that it's naturalized, it's normalized, it's the way things are. So it's very hard for people, even the victims of all of this. But I think, you know, we really have to focus, too, on what's different about the United States that makes it, well, the gun violence at the very basic domestic level, but also the world militarism and violence. And as we speak, people are being bombed all over the place in the Middle East and Afghanistan and Africa in undeclared wars. So it's almost like it's history playing itself out, what Richard Slotkin calls a regeneration of violence. This initial conquest and culture, the culture of violence, almost having to repeat itself to refresh the nationalism, you know, the ties with that sort of bloodlust that develops. You know, the gun ownership now, 74% of gun owners in the United States are male, and 82% are white, so that's 61% of all adults who own guns are white men, and they account for only 31% of the population. And the average number of guns that these people own, these white men, are 8, which means that many own, like the killer in Las Vegas, 58 guns, 48. Okay, I don't think they've even found them all yet.
Roxanne, there's a direct relationship between white gun ownership and laws passed in the United States before the American Revolution requiring white males to carry guns even as they were walking to church. Can you talk about that law and why it existed?
Yeah, in the 17th century already, you had laws that not just walking to church, but carrying into church in the fields to be armed at all times. And you made a very important point, Joanna, about the obligation of the settler to be the builder of empire and recipient of the rewards. So this is really the basis of U.S. democracy or U.S. equal rights, is everyone has the right to kill Indians and and buy and use enslaved Africans. Not everyone can do it, you know, because it's whoever works hardest. But those are really the aspirations. So you have it spreading to very poor whites, and let's say that at first the indentured who came in and worked through their tenure, whatever contract they had for labor, whose main goal when they're then finished with that, paid it off with labor, is themselves to be in that position, you know, to buy slaves.
Roxanne, could you touch on the importance of the 1632 colonial government laws that required each person to have functioning firearms and ammunition, and how that law evolved into the next century?
Yes, the law started very early. The colony was founded in 1620, and then 16 years later, they were already requiring that every settler, male, of course, white male, have firearms and ammunition, and if they could not afford to support that, the colony would subsidize. But they were required to have this, and they were required to carry those weapons ready to fire everywhere. If they stepped outside their door, carry the weapon, carry to church, in church, to meetings out in the fields, if they were out in the fields working. And what for? They were clearly on Indian land. It was very new. And, yes, the Native people were resisting having their land taken away from them. And they had appropriated Native farmers' land that already existed, very well-developed deer parks, oyster beds. They appropriated those things, so it left the Native people without any subsistence. It wasn't just they were just running around on that land. They had developed it. So the idea that it was because it was in the wilderness and they had to fight off bears and Indians as if Indians were savage animals. What's really disturbing is that, you know, this genealogy is so clear and well-known, and yet the liberal argument, the Democratic Party, the gun control lobby, insist, and whole books written on it, this Gunning for America that just came out last year by an excellent historian, Pamela Haig, is basically a history of the Winchester Rifle Company. But she prefaces it with a complete denunciation of how guns are used now was historically based, or that the Second Amendment meant anything at all. It's just denial, and that instead it's the gun industry. Fine, capitalism is to blame, but, you know, there are steps in between. How did that capitalism come to exist, and guns were an essential part of it? It's puzzling to me why this denial.
Part of what you reveal is that there's a relationship between the savage war that colonists launched against Native Americans and enslaved Africans and the emerging military culture in the United States. So how did this early history in the United States, this early violence against Native Americans, influence even contemporary military institutions?
That's what my Indigenous People's History of the United States, you know, could have been called Military History of the United States, because that's exactly the development of the U.S. military. And you'll see in almost every, you may kind of have to make an exception of World War One and World War Two, which were very short periods of time when the United States is at war, but it's every day of war since the Anglos stepped foot in North America. There's been war somewhere. They're making war. It is the culture. We have a militaristic culture under the guise of being, a model civilian government with no no militarism, no authority by the military. Yet the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. So that illusion of a professional military, there is this parallel throughout United States history. In the Constitution, they created the U.S. Army, that is the heir of the Army today. A little later, they created the Navy, well, the Marines first. The Marines were created even before the Constitution. And the Marines are a prototype of this counterinsurgency and savage warfare. They're created for that. They're like the ultimate counterinsurgent body and the most admired. Every Marine is a shooter. No desk jobs, none of that. That's the Navy takes care of that. They are killers. That's what they're trained for. That's what they're for. And, of course, all these special forces that are on that model, too, have been created. Those are directly from the development of these militias that are provided for in the Second Amendment, whereas the regular army was created in the Constitution and given full, plus the state militias, which are different, the colonial militias that became the state militias, which eventually became the National Guard, those are provided for in the Constitution. So the Second Amendment is an individual right and responsibility, and that's why the Second Amendment is sacred to these individuals who want to uphold white nationalism. And I don't just mean the ones we considered crazies with swastikas and, you know, obvious Ku Klux Klan, David Duke, but basically the majority of the white population of the United States assumes white supremacy without understanding that in not dealing with the just not wanting to deal with the realities of what our problems are. Yet now, you know, we're in the a situation where if we don't look at this, it's really almost immoral, you know, because it's so obvious, you know, flashing. You know, I really wrote this book mainly for the left. On the left, we need to really dig into history and understand what we're dealing with, because if we don't know exactly what the country we're dealing with, it's not the country we want it to be, but we have to be honest with ourselves. It doesn't mean in our organizing we have to hit people with all of this right at first, you know, but we at least have to really deeply understand it. And I think because there's a kind of self-righteousness about being a social justice person, that we're on the right side of things, that there's also a reluctance to... The other thing I think is important is a black-red alliance of these, not only all these militias that slave patrols came out of, too. There was this period of time when you can't really separate marooning, which is usually identified with enslaved Africans, from native marooning, because they're being pushed out. And their struggles together, and of course there are three long wars, 50 years altogether, the Seminole Wars, declared wars by the United States, and the resistors in Florida and Everglades, it's a marooning area. And the Seminole Indians become the base of it. But enslaved Africans can escape to this huge maroon area, and they never defeat them. So we have to understand this relationship. And I think it makes it so much more powerful, because Native scholars write about the Native situation. African-American scholars write about African-American. And often they don't mention each other at all.
Thank you, Roxanne, for going into such depth on the rarely mentioned Maroons and the relationship between Native Americans and African slaves. I want to ask something about your assertion that the arms industry was, in effect, the anchor of early American economy. Can you briefly describe that?
Well, it was one of the most successful. United States is became, New England especially, gun manufacturing, of course, because of the requirement and the proliferation of guns. They got more and more improved, more and more powerful. Plus, the military, as it, the Indian Wars, were commissioning a lot of these, like the Winchester rifle was commissioned for to kill Plains Indians, the Buffalo people, very effectively. Some of that really got speeded up, of course, during the Civil War, and then the huge Hotchkiss and, you know, almost automatic gunfire created for the rest of the Indian Wars, simply a huge technological developments. But the gun industry is still, well, military, machinery, and guns are still very strong corporations and healthy ones in the United States, unlike most corporations. They're not the only ones. They're gun manufacturers, and of course in Germany, some of the very best ones, in Russia, Czechoslovakia, Israel, but they come nowhere near the U.S. export of weapons. So I think there's a relationship of, you know, it's two-track, the military and domestic, but also when you have constant warfare on television and all, it happened in the 70s too, there's an uptick in domestic gun hoarding, and that happened in the 70s, and that's the period we're still in which, you know, the NRA itself got taken over by white nationalists in 1975, and transformed into a really a white nationalist organization. So the Vietnam War, out of that came, you know, a lot more weapons. And now we see that again with these Middle Eastern wars that, you know, with the Gulf War in 1991 up to the present. And the main, these white men who are the main owners of multiple guns, they are, majority of them are, combat veterans.
One of the revelations of your book is around the American Revolution. Contrary to popular belief, the American Revolution was not about taxation without representation, as we learn in the mainstream and in high school. The American Revolution had a lot to do with the inability of the colonists to expand beyond the Ohio River, a desire that was limited or made illegal by the British Empire. Can you talk about that conflict? Can you help us understand how your history of gun violence and land conquest influences the colonists and their revolt against the British Empire?
Yeah, that's a real turning point. The French and Indian War that was being fought in Europe. It's a 7 years war, but it was mainly colonists killing Indians in the French and Indian War in North America. By then, plantation, this is 1750, by then plantation agriculture was very strongly rooted and very productive and very wealth-producing for those who involved in it, as well as the ownership of enslaved African bodies. And the problem with commercial agriculture then and today is that it wears out the soil, because for Native people, they left fields fallow to regain their nutrients and all, and they let it, you know, refresh itself. But with commercial agriculture, it's they simply kill the land. Then they have to have more land in order to continue being wealthy. So that was the urge, and this was, I mean, these moves were into the Ohio country, over the Appalachian, Allegheny Mountains. Yeah, that after that French-Indian War, the French lost, the British won, but they agreed to, they didn't want to have wars anymore, so they agreed to make that mountain chain a demarcation, and they made this proclamation that no settlers, no Anglo settlers, were to cross over that mountain chain, and those who had already illegally, because a lot of the fighting was out there, you know, taking Indian land during the French and Indian War, they had to return.
The English crown made it illegal.
Yes.
To acquire land beyond the Ohio River.
Exactly. And that was their proclamation after the French and Indian War, because they didn't want further. The French had traders, but they didn't do settler colonialism there. So they said, you know, trading posts, that's fine, you know, but not settlement. So the main person who had been surveying and actually selling pieces of land they didn't own even before, you know, before this proclamation was George Washington. He was the head of the Virginia militia. And he led whole survey parties into the Ohio Valley, taking the land. Remember, these are very settled indigenous farmers living in villages. So they burn their villages, they take their land forcibly, and then they sell that land. They're land speculators. They sell it to settlers, and especially landless or land poor settlers who want to become planters and become wealthy, like Andrew Jackson, to be able to get cheap land. And even though it's illegal, almost certain that they can get the British to, you know, to claim, okay, it's a fait accompli. But then instead, the British did the proclamation. And so this is the taxation without representation is really based on the expense the British had to do to guard that demarcation line, and also to send redcoats in, or colonial militias, supposedly, in to make these settlers come back. And that was, you know, part of the Bill of Rights, the Ten Amendments about billeting soldiers and things. People have, what is all that about? Well, there was also the Stamp Act, which imposed a sterling, you know, it couldn't be paper money, local money, but a sterling fine or taxation to pay for this expense. The colonies were to pay for it because it was the law of the British Empire. So that was where the taxation without representation came from, is having to pay for the Stamp Act and to carry out the law of the proclamation and non-settlement. So really, that and the end of the Atlantic slave trade legally by Britain, the anti-slavery society in Britain, very successful in ending that, it would mean a eventual end to legalized slavery. I believe those are the two elements of why the United States wanted independence, was to be able to expand, because there were, you know, those who gathered together as those leaders, every single one of them, were land speculators. You know, capitalism had already, its kernel already based in land and African bodies. So we have to understand the development of U.S. capitalism that didn't, what was it based on? What was the primary accumulation that it created, the most powerful economic power in the world? We can't just follow some European tract of how it developed in England or France or, you know, mainly England, as usual, you know, but how it developed in the United States and on what basis And why maintaining white dominance, white supremacy, is so encoded in all of it that it's just the norm. You know, it's not some additive thing or some mental disturbance. It's the norm. And that's why it's so difficult to deal with, because people, especially liberals, think they're benevolent, you know, and they want to help people and improve them, lift them up. But actually, not to change the structure that would really threaten dominance.
Your book is Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, it's published by City Lights. How can listeners learn more about you or find out where you're speaking?
Well, I have a website, reddirtsite.com, and I try to keep it up to date. And also City Lights has my speaking schedule for Loaded, but I also do other kinds of talks, working on a new book on Nation of Immigrants with a question mark after it that I've been doing some speaking on, too. So that's on my website. If you Google me, you'll find lots of videos of interviews and lectures I've done, and also the audio ones as well.
Roxanne, as always, it's really an honor to have you with us, and we wish you all the best of luck with this truly important book.
Thank you, Heidi, and thank you, Johanna.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Catholic-affiliated hospitals set strict guidelines that prohibit doctors from providing contraceptives, sterilization, abortion, and fertility services regardless of their patients' wishes or their doctor's medical judgment or the standard of care in the medical profession. A just-released report titled Bearing Faith, The Limits of Catholic Healthcare for Women of Color by the Columbia Law School's Public Rights Private Conscience Project in partnership with Public Health Solutions shows that in many states, women of color are far more likely than white women to give birth at Catholic hospitals. These women are at greater risk of having their health needs undermined because these health needs have been determined by the religious beliefs of male bishops rather than the medical judgment of their doctors. This religious overreach undermines fundamental rights to equality and liberty and violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which seeks to separate church from state. We speak today with attorney Kira Shepherd, a co-author of the report, which was produced in partnership with Public Health Solutions. Shepherd is the director of the Racial Justice Program of Public Rights Private Conscience Project at Columbia Law School. We speak as well with attorney Elizabeth Reiner Platt. Liz Platt is the director of the project at the Columbia Law School.
Kira and Liz, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
If you will, tell us what the Public Rights Private Conscience Project is.
Absolutely. So the Public Rights Private Conscience Project, or PRPCP, we are a law and policy think tank. We're based in Columbia Law School. And our mission is to promote a more nuanced understanding of the meaning and the scope of religious liberty rights under the Constitution. So in particular, we've done a lot of work around laws and lawsuits, where we've seen that some of the efforts to accommodate individual religious liberty rights has become just so enormously broad that they actually start to threaten to violate other, you know, fundamental rights, including the Establishment Clause, which is the limit between the boundary of separation of church and state.
Specifically, what range of services do the religious guidelines governing care at Catholic-affiliated hospitals prohibit?
So one thing we do at this report, we look at the way that religious exemption laws, or we look at the way the ethical religious directives impact women of color, and we decided to do this particular report under the Racial Justice Project of the Public Rights Private Conscience Project. And the Racial Justice Project, we look at the way that religious exemption laws impact people of color. So going back to the report, the ethical and religious directives, they prohibit contraception, sterilization, fertility treatments, end-of-life care, abortion, certain types of treatment for ectopic pregnancies, and tubal ligations. And to put this into a little bit more context, I often tell the story of Tamisha Means. Tamisha Means is an African-American woman, and in 2010, when she was 18 weeks pregnant, she went to a Catholic hospital in her area. She didn't know it was a Catholic hospital. It was the only Catholic hospital in her area. And she went after her water broke. She went there in excruciating pain, and they turned her away. She went back a second time, and they examined her. They realized that the fetus was no longer viable, but instead of telling her this or referring her to a different hospital, they just turned her away the second time, and it wasn't until the third time that she came and she began to miscarry that they treated her. And the issue here was that under the appropriate standard of care, they should have evacuated the uterus, because at the time, during that second visit, they realized that she was facing a life-threatening complication. But they turned her away continuously because of the ethical religious directives that they were under.
We want to get more into the report that you just referenced, but I have a quick question. How would I know if the hospital I went to was Catholic?
Patients don't know if it's a Catholic hospital when they go to the hospital. And I think that was the issue that Tamisha Means had. And that's the issue a number of women who I've spoken to had when they went to a Catholic hospital for care. And even if they can tell that it's a Catholic hospital because there might be a cross on it or because of the name of the hospital, many times they don't know that these hospitals fall under these ethical and religious directives. And lately what we're finding with a lot of these Catholic hospitals is that because they're merging with community hospitals, the community hospital could have formerly been a community hospital, just your regular hospital that you go to receive the care you need. And then once they merge with a Catholic hospital and have to fall under these ethical religious directives, certain type of care is limited, but people in the community don't even know those changes were made to their hospital.
You've alluded to this, but can you specifically explain how Catholic hospital regulations depart from standards of care established by the medical profession?
Sure. So I think there are a lot of individual situations in which we know that the care being offered deviates from standard of care related to specifically miscarriage management and access to contraception and sterilization. For example, we know that tubal ligations are safest when they occur immediately after a birth because you're avoiding another unnecessary and very invasive surgery, yet those are not offered in many Catholic hospitals. Another thing I want to point out is that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists actually has a guidance document specifically on religious healthcare refusals. It's called The Limits of Conscientious Refusal in Reproductive Medicine. And that guideline states that conscientious refusal should be limited if they constitute an imposition of religious or moral beliefs on patients, negatively affect a patient's health, are based on scientific misinformation, or create or reinforce racial or socioeconomic inequalities. The guidelines from ACOG also state that healthcare providers have to provide accurate and unbiased information so that patients know all of the range of healthcare options they have and can make informed decisions about the care that they receive. And that when physicians are deviating from standard practice, that they inform patients about the religious refusal and that they refer them to another provider who can provide the care that they need. Now, not every single Catholic hospital interprets the ERDs in the exact same way, so there can be a range of treatment. That said, you know, we know that there are examples where these standards outlined by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists is not being followed. Women are not receiving timely referrals to get access to care. As in the case of Tamisha Means that Kira talked about, we know that she was not told, given accurate information about her condition, and in fact was told that there was a chance that her pregnancy, she would be able to have a healthy pregnancy, which the doctors knew at that time was not a realistic option. So, yeah, absolutely, the best medical practices. There are certainly situations where we know that there are conflicts between how the ERDs are being applied and best medical practice.
Liz, Kira, do these Catholic hospitals get government money?
Yes. Catholic hospitals get billions in taxpayer dollars through Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements. So according to one study by our friends at the ACLU and Merger Watch, in 2011, Catholic-sponsored and affiliated hospitals reported receiving $27 billion in combined Medicare and Medicaid net revenue. And that number actually doesn't even include hospital reimbursements from Medicare and Medicaid managed care plans. Another thing I'll mention is that the condition of participation in these plans is compliance with the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, or EMTALA. And what that law does is it requires emergency rooms to stabilize a patient before releasing them. Again, for example, in the case of Tamisha Means, that's a really great example, but there are others, we know of others, where folks who come in and are miscarrying and, you know, require miscarriage management, where they are either released or in some cases where the Catholic hospital does refer a patient, maybe either released or referred to a hospital, you know, could be miles away without being stabilized and without getting the care they need. So in addition to the medical standards of care that I spoke about earlier, there are actually cases in which the ERDs are in conflict with EMTALA, with federal law.
Do other church-affiliated social service providers get government money, like schools or counseling or food relief programs?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Faith-based organizations get billions of dollars from not just federal, but also state and local governments to offer just an enormously broad range of services, from healthcare, housing, services for youth, services for elders, drug rehabilitation programs, an enormous range of social services. I will say that certainly not all faith-based service providers place any sort of religious restrictions on the services that they provide. So there are faith-based organizations that get government grants and then are willing to hire and provide services on a non-discriminatory basis and to provide all the services that they're being funded to provide. So I think the really troubling issue is where organizations are, you know, taking these government grants and then refusing to provide the exact services that they're being funded to provide. So, you know, another example of this is there are faith-based organizations that receive large grants to provide services to unaccompanied minors crossing the border, some of whom are sexually assaulted and may need access to comprehensive reproductive health services, including emergency contraception and abortion. And there have been instances where we've seen that the organizations that are responsible for the care of these minors have refused to provide reproductive health services.
We're speaking with Liz Platt and Kira Shepherd, both attorneys at the Columbia Law School, and we're talking about the we've really come down to the basic question, and that's, what's the proper balance between religious liberty rights and LGBTQ, reproductive, racial justice, educational rights? How do you balance those? My own bias is that you don't balance them, that there should be an absolute separation from church and state. But we don't have that here. I'm not sure why, but let's talk about the broader philosophical issue. How do you balance those? How do you keep the church at a distance?
One stance that we've always taken at the think tank, and I believe, is that religious liberty rights are important and should be respected, but I think the issue comes in when they undermine other fundamental rights to equality and liberty. So when religious liberty rights are used in a way where you can discriminate against someone else or you can refuse them the care that they need, which causes harm, well, that's when there's an issue. So there's something called third-party harm. So when religious liberty rights are used in a way that where they harm third parties, that's where the line should be drawn.
Liz, did you want to add to that?
Sure. You know, one thing I'll say is that I think that sometimes it can be sort of a false conflict. For example, when there are laws that specifically protect certain religious views about sex, marriage, reproduction, that's not necessarily a law that's protecting everyone's religious beliefs. So, for example, there are a lot of doctors and healthcare providers whose own personal religious views and conscience says that they should be providing comprehensive reproductive health care to their patients. And so laws that allow their religious employer restrict the care that they are able to provide actually goes against their own conscience. So, you know, I think it's important to remember that there's a huge diversity of religious beliefs around sex, marriage, and reproduction, and laws that specifically protect one of those views don't necessarily really protect everyone's religious liberty. So it's not just a conflict between religion and LGBTQ rights, but it's really, you know, promoting a particular view about religion. Another example are cases where folks are arguing for a right to reduce the scope of anti-discrimination laws are really going to end up harming religious minorities who depend on really robust civil rights and anti-discrimination laws in order to practice their religion while participating as citizens in the public sphere. So, you know, I would just push back against the fact that it's necessarily always this conflict between religion versus other rights. In fact, there can be ways in which those rights are actually harmonized.
Tell us how listeners can learn more about your work, please.
Sure. Come visit us on our website. It's at Public Rights Private Conscience Project. You can just Google it and get on our mailing list. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. And just reach out to us. I mean, our information's right there on the webpage. If you have ideas for things we should be looking at, projects we should be taking up, or opportunities for partnership, please just reach out.
And the report, Bearing Faith, the Limits of Catholic Healthcare for Women of Color, is on that site.
It's online.
One more time. What's the site?
The name is, it's the Public Rights Private Conscience Project.
Liz, Kara, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. We really appreciate your coming down to the studio. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much
for having us.
Thank you.
Great. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.